You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of How to Know Higher Worlds, A Modern Path of Initiation by Rudolf Steiner, the Bamford translation. This is Chapter 2, entitled The Stages of Initiation. Paragraph 1. The following information forms part of a spiritual training, whose name and essential nature will become clear to anyone who makes use of it in the right way. It concerns the three stages by which the school of spiritual life leads to a certain degree of initiation. But only those explanations that may be made public will be found here. They are indications derived from a much deeper, more intimate teaching. In the esoteric school, from which these communications are drawn, the student follows a definite course of instruction. Specific tasks and exercises are used there to bring the human soul into a conscious relationship with the spiritual world. These more esoteric practices compare with those presented here as instruction given in a rigorously disciplined higher school or college compares with what is taught incidentally as preparation in a lower school. Yet, the sincere and unwavering pursuit of what is intimated here nevertheless leads to real esoteric training. Impatient experimentation, without sincerity and persistence, however, will get us nowhere. We can succeed in esoteric study only when the indications given in the previous chapter are observed and made the foundation of further work. Paragraph 2. Three stages of initiation are described in the tradition from which this schooling derives: preparation, illumination, and initiation. These three stages do not follow each other so rigidly that it is absolutely necessary to complete one stage fully before going on to the next. A person may receive illumination and even initiation in relation to some things, while remaining at the stage of preparation in relation to others. Nevertheless, a student must spend a certain amount of time in preparation before the stage of illumination can begin, and only after illumination has taken place, at least regarding certain things, can initiation begin. For simplicity's sake, however, the description that follows will discuss the three stages in sequence. Subsection Preparation. Paragraph 3. The stage of preparation consists in a quite definite method of cultivating our lives of feeling and thinking. Just as natural forces equip the physical body with organs fashioned from unstructured living matter, so the care and cultivation of our lives of feeling and thinking endow our soul and spiritual bodies with higher senses and organs of activity. Paragraph 4. The first step is to direct the soul's attention toward certain processes in the world around us. These processes are life, as it buds, grows, and flourishes. And on the other hand, all phenomena connected with withering, fading, and dying away. Wherever we turn our eyes, these two processes are present together. By their nature, they always evoke feelings and thoughts in us. Normally, however, we do not give ourselves sufficiently to these feelings and thoughts. We rush from one sense impression to the next. Now, however, we must consciously and intensively focus our full attention on them. Whenever we perceive a quite definite form of blossoming and flourishing, we must banish all else from our souls, and for a short time dwell on this one impression alone. As we do so, we will soon realize that a feeling that previously only flitted through our souls has now grown and become strong and filled with energy. We must let this feeling quietly echo within us. We must become inwardly completely still, cutting ourselves off from the rest of the world around us. We must attend only to what the soul has to tell us about the facts of blossoming and flourishing. Paragraph 5. But attending to our souls in this way should not lead us to believe that we shall advance far on the path if we blunt our senses to the world. First, we must look at things as actively and precisely as possible. Only thereafter should we devote ourselves to the feelings coming to life in our souls and the thoughts arising there. It is essential that we give our attention to both feelings and thoughts as they arise in complete inner equilibrium. If we find the necessary inner peace, surrendering ourselves to what comes to life in our souls, then after a certain time we will experience the following. We will notice, rising up within us, new kinds of feelings and thoughts that we never knew before. The more often we focus our attention, first on something growing and flourishing, and then on something withering and dying away, the more lively and active these feelings will become. Eventually, just as the eyes and ears of our physical organism are formed by natural forces out of inanimate matter, so organs of clairvoyant, in quotes, seeing are formed out of the feelings and thoughts that arise in relation to growing and flourishing, withering and dying. If we cultivate our feeling life in this way, we will find that a specific form of feeling is attached to processes of growing and becoming, while quite another is attached to those of withering and dying. These forms of feeling may be described, but only approximately. Each student may obtain a complete idea of them, however, by going through the inner experience. Whoever repeatedly directs his or her attention to processes of becoming, flourishing, and blossoming, will feel something faintly resembling the sensation we experience as we watch the sun rise. Processes of withering and dying, on the other hand, will produce an experience that may be compared with what we feel as we watch the slow rise of the moon on the horizon. Cultivated appropriately, and trained in ever livelier and more active fashion, these two types of feeling become forces that can lead to the most significant spiritual effects. Deliberately, regularly, and repeatedly surrendering to such feelings, we find a new world opening before us. The soul world, or so-called astral plane, begins to dawn. Growth and decay are now no longer merely facts, evoking vague impressions, as they were before. Instead, they form definite spiritual lines and figures we had no inkling of before. What is more, these lines and figures change their forms with the phenomena. A blossoming flower conjures up a particular line before our souls, while a growing animal or a dying tree gives rise to other lines. In this way, the soul world, or astral plane, spreads out before us. These lines and figures are not arbitrary. Two students at the same level of development will see the same lines and figures associated with the same processes. Just as two healthy people with good eyes both see a round table as round, and neither sees it as rectangular, so in the presence of a flower, two souls both see the same spiritual form arising. Just as biologists customarily describe and classify plants and animals according to their forms, which are the same for every observer, so experts in spiritual science describe and characterize the spiritual forms of the processes of growth and death, and distinguish various species and types among them. Paragraph 6. Once we have advanced to the point where we can see the spiritual forms of what appears physically visible to our outer eyes, then we are not far from the stage of seeing things that have no physical existence at all. Such things, of course, remain completely hidden, or occult, to one who has received no esoteric training. Paragraph 7. Here it must be emphasized that the spiritual researchers should not lose themselves in reflection upon what this or that might mean. Mental activity of this kind will only lead us astray. We should look out at the world with healthy, alert senses and a keen power of observation, and then give ourselves over to our feelings. We should not try to determine what things mean with the speculative mind, but should let things themselves tell us their meaning. Footnote. It should be noted that artistic feeling or sensitivity, coupled with a quiet inward nature, is the most promising precondition for developing spiritual faculties. Such artistic sensitivity penetrates through the surface of things and thus reaches their secrets. The end of footnote. Paragraph 8. Another important point is what esoteric science calls, in quotes, orientation in the higher worlds. We achieve such an orientation when we have filled ourselves completely with the consciousness that feelings and thoughts are actual facts, just as real as tables and chairs are in the physical sensory world. In the worlds of soul and thought, feelings and thoughts affect one another just as sensory things do in the physical world. Until we are actively filled with the consciousness of the reality of thoughts and feelings, we cannot believe that entertaining a wrong thought can have as devastating an effect on the other thoughts that animate our thought world as a bullet shot blindly from a rifle has on things it hits in the physical world. Thus, although we may never allow ourselves to engage in visible actions that we consider meaningless, we, nonetheless, do not shrink from entertaining wrong thoughts or feelings because these do not seem to us to be dangerous to the rest of the world. To move forward on the path to higher knowledge and advance in spiritual science, we must therefore pay as careful attention to our thoughts and feelings as we do to our movements in the physical world. For instance, we do not usually try to go straight through a wall, but direct our steps around it. That is, we comply with the laws of the physical world. The world of feelings and thoughts, likewise, has its own laws, but they do not force themselves upon us from the outside. Rather, they must flow out of the life of the soul. For this to occur, we must never allow ourselves false thoughts and feelings. Random musings, playful daydreams, the arbitrary ebb and flow of feeling, all these must be banished from the soul. We need not fear that this will make us unfeeling. On the contrary, we will find that only when we regulate our inner life in this way do we become truly rich in feelings and creative in genuine imagination. Important feelings and fruitful thoughts will then take the place of petty indulgence in emotions and the playful association of ideas. These, in turn, will help us to orient ourselves in the spiritual world, thereby allowing us to enter into a right relationship with the things in it. And this, too, has a definite noticeable effect. Just as we find our way as physical beings among the things of the physical world, so now our path leads us through the phenomena of growing and dying away as we come to know these in the manner described above. We follow the processes of growing and flourishing, decaying and dying, just as our own and the world's development require. Paragraph 9. The students of occult knowledge must also direct their attention to the world of sounds. Here we must distinguish between sounds produced by so-called inanimate objects, such as a falling object, a bell, or a musical instrument, and those coming from living beings, animals or human beings. If we hear a bell, we perceive the sound and associate it with a pleasant feeling. The scream of an animal, on the other hand, not only evokes an emotional association, but also reveals the animal's inner experience, its pleasure or its pain. In esoteric training, we focus on the second type of sound, concentrating our whole attention on the fact that the sound communicates something that lies outside our own souls. We must immerse ourselves in this otherness, inwardly uniting our feelings with the pain or pleasure expressed by the sound. To do this, we must disregard what the sound is for us, whether it is pleasant or unpleasant, agreeable or disagreeable. Our soul must be filled only with what is happening in the being from whom the sound comes. If we practice this exercise systematically and deliberately, we will acquire, as we do so, the faculty of merging, as it were, with the being that made the sound. A musically sensitive person will naturally find this particular exercise for the cultivation of soul life easier than one who is unmusical. But no one should think that a musical ear is a substitute for systematically doing the exercise. As occult students, our goal is to learn to feel toward the whole of nature in this way. As we learn to do so, a new faculty takes root in the world of feeling and thought. All of nature begins to whisper its secrets to us through its sounds. Sounds that were previously incomprehensible to our soul now become the meaningful language of nature. Where we had heard only noise in the sounds produced by inanimate objects, we now learn a new language of the soul. As this cultivation of our feelings continues, we become aware that we can hear things we never conceived of before. Indeed, we begin to hear with our souls. Paragraph 10. Something must be added to this practice before the highest point in this region of soul experience can be attained. Particularly important as we develop as occult pupils is that we also work on the way we listen to other people when they speak. On the path to higher knowledge, this listening skill is extremely important. We must become accustomed to listening in such a way that we quiet our own inner life completely when we listen. For example, when someone expresses an opinion and another listens, agreement or disagreement usually stirs immediately within the listener. Often in such a situation, we feel compelled to express our own opinion at once, especially if we disagree. However, on the path to higher knowledge, we must learn to silence any agreement or disagreement with the opinions we hear. Naturally, this does not mean that we should suddenly change our way of life and strive to achieve this complete inner silence all the time. We must start with isolated instances that we choose intentionally. Then, quite slowly and gradually, as if by itself, this new way of listening will become a habit. In spiritual research, we practice this new way of listening in a systematic way. As students, we should feel it our duty to set aside, as an exercise, certain times when we listen to the most contrary opinions, completely silencing within us all agreement and especially all negative judgments. Not only must we silence our intellectual judgment, but also any feelings of disapproval, rejection, or even agreement. Above all, we must observe ourselves carefully to ensure that such feelings, even though absent from the surface of the soul, are not present in its innermost depths. For example, we must learn to listen to the remarks of those who are in some way inferior to us, suppressing every feeling of superiority or knowing better. Listening to children in this way is especially useful, and even the wisest of us can learn a great deal from them. These exercises teach us to listen selflessly to the words of others, completely excluding our own personality, opinions, and feelings. Once we have practiced in listening in this way, without criticism, then gradually, even when the most contradictory views and illogical statements are aired before us, we begin to learn how to unite ourselves with the being of the other person and fully enter into it. We begin to hear through the words into the other person's soul. As we consistently practice this new habit, sound becomes the medium through which we can perceive soul and spirit. This practice requires the strictest self-discipline, but it also leads to a lofty goal. For when the exercise is combined with those given above, in connection with sounds in nature, then a new sense of hearing comes to life in the soul. The soul becomes capable of hearing, in quotes, words from the spiritual world that are not expressed in outer tones and cannot be heard by physical ears. Perception of the, quote, inner word, close quote, awakens. Truths are gradually revealed to us out of the spiritual world. We hear ourselves spoken to spiritually. Footnote: only when we have learned to listen selflessly and to be inwardly receptive, without any personal opinion or feeling stirring in us, can the higher beings described by spiritual science speak to us. The beings of the spiritual world will remain silent as long as we still pit any personal feelings or opinions against what we hear from others. End of footnote. All higher truths are attained only through such inward prompting. Whatever we hear from the lips of true spiritual researchers is only what they have brought into experience in this way. This does not mean that it is unnecessary to study esoteric literature before we ourselves have become able to hear this, quote, inner word, close quote. On the contrary, reading such writings and listening to the teachings of esoteric researchers are themselves a means of achieving knowledge for ourselves. Indeed, every statement of spiritual science that we hear is intended to guide the mind in the direction it must take if the soul is to experience any true progress. Therefore, the exercises described here should be accompanied by the intensive study of what researchers in spiritual science bring into the world. Such study is part of the preparatory work in all schools of esoteric training. In fact, all the other methods taken together will not get us anywhere if we do not also absorb the teachings of esoteric researchers. These teachings are drawn forth from the living, quote, inner word, close quote, from, quote, living inspiration, close quote, and therefore they themselves are spiritually alive. They are not just words. They are living forces. And as we follow the words of one experienced in esoteric knowledge, or read a book based on true inner experience, forces are at work in our souls that make us seers, clairvoyants, just as the forces of nature have shaped our eyes and ears out of living matter. Subsection entitled Illumination, paragraph 11. The stage of illumination starts from very simple processes. Here, too, as in the stage of preparation, it is a matter of developing and awakening certain feelings and thoughts latent in every one of us. Anyone who focuses on these simple processes with persistence, rigor, and complete patience will be led to a perception of the inner manifestations of light. We begin by examining different natural objects in a particular way. For example, a transparent, beautifully shaped stone, a crystal, a plant, and an animal. First, we try to direct our whole attention to comparing a stone and an animal. The thoughts that we form to make this comparison must pass through the soul, accompanied by lively feelings. No other thoughts or feelings must be allowed to intrude and disturb our intense, attention-filled observation. We should say to ourselves, quote, "The stone has a form. The animal also has a form. The stone stays peacefully in its place. The animal changes its place. It is instinct or desire that moves the animal to change its place. Instincts are also served by the animal's form. Its organs and limbs are shaped by these instincts. Stones, on the other hand, are not shaped by desires, but rather by a force that is without desire." Footnote: the above-mentioned facts concerning the contemplation of crystals have been distorted and misrepresented by people who have only superficial, exoteric knowledge of them. This has led to notions of, in quotes, "crystal gazing," and so on. Such distortions are based on misunderstandings. Although they have been described in many books, they are in no way a subject of true esoteric spiritual teaching. End of footnote. As we immerse ourselves intensely in these thoughts, observing stone and animal with close attention, two very different kinds of feeling come to life in the soul. One kind streams into the soul from the stone, another from the animal. Although this exercise will probably not succeed in the beginning, gradually, if we practice with real patience, the two feelings will eventually appear. We need only practice the exercise over and over again. At first, the feelings persist only as long as the observation lasts. Later, they continue to work on after the exercise is over. Eventually, they become something that remains alive in our souls. At that point, we need only to reflect for stone and animal feelings to arise again, even without the contemplation of an external object. Out of these feelings and the thoughts accompanying them, organs of clairvoyance are formed. If we add plants to our observations, we notice that the feeling streaming from a plant, both in its nature and intensity, lies midway between what streams from a stone and what streams from an animal. The organs built up in this way are spiritual eyes. They gradually allow us to see soul and spiritual colors. But as long as we have not made our own what was previously described as the path or stage of preparation, the lines and figures of the spiritual world remain dark. Through the process of illumination, they become light. Here, again, it must be noted that the words used, such as dark and light, as well as other expressions, are only approximations of what is meant. Our ordinary languages were created for physical relationships. if we use ordinary language, as we must, only approximations of spiritual phenomena are possible. Thus, occult science describes what clairvoyant organs perceive as flowing from stones, as blue or blue-red, while what flows from animals is described as red or red-yellow. In fact, the colors seen are spiritual colors. The color streaming from plants is green, gradually fading into a light etheric rose pink. Plants are actually the only natural beings whose constitution in the higher worlds resembles to some extent their constitution in the physical world. This is not the case with stones or animals. Obviously, the above mentioned colors represent only the main tones of the mineral, animal, and plant kingdoms. In reality, all possible intermediary hues exist. Each stone, plant, and animal has its own particular color nuance. To this picture must be added the beings of the higher worlds that never incarnate physically. Their colors can be magnificent, but sometimes they are horrible. On the whole, the range of color in the higher worlds is immeasurably greater than in the physical world. Paragraph 12. Once we achieve the capacity of seeing with spiritual eyes, we sooner or later meet the higher beings mentioned above, as well as sometimes also those beings lower than we who never enter our physical reality. Paragraph 13. Having brought our practice to the point described here, paths to many worlds lie open before us. But no one is advised to proceed further without paying careful attention to what is said or communicated by spiritual researchers. In fact, even with regard to what has already been said, it is always best to heed experienced guidance. Naturally, if we have the strength and persistence to reach these elementary levels of illumination, we will certainly seek and find the right kind of direction. Paragraph 14. One precaution, at all events, is essential, and whoever is unwilling to adopt it had better not proceed in occult science at all. As esoteric students, we must not lose any of our human qualities, but must remain noble-minded, good people, sensitive to all aspects of physical reality. In fact, throughout the course of our esoteric training, we must continuously increase our moral strength, inner integrity, and faculty of observation. During the basic exercises, for example, we must seek to enlarge not only our compassion for the human and animal worlds, but also our sense for the beauty of nature. If we do not bear this in mind, then both these feelings and our aesthetic sense will be dulled by the exercises. Our heart will become hard, our senses blunted. Clearly, this would have dangerous consequences. Paragraph 15. What happens in the stage of illumination, after we have practiced the stone, plant, and animal exercises, and have risen to a consideration of the human being, and how, after illumination, the soul unites with the spiritual world under all circumstances, and so is led to initiation, all this the next sections will describe, insofar as it is possible to do so. Paragraph 16. Many people today seek a path to occult or esoteric science. Their quest takes various forms. Many dangerous and even illicit practices are tried. Therefore, those who believe that they know something of the truth in these matters should give others the opportunity to learn something about esoteric training. This book presents such an opportunity, nothing more. Something of the truth must be made known to prevent error from causing great harm. No harm will come to anyone on this path, provided he or she does not seek to force results. Just one thing must be borne in mind. We should not spend more time and energy on these exercises than is in keeping with our position and duties in life. Pursuing a path of esoteric training should never lead to any sudden change in one's life situation. If we want real results, we must have patience. We must be able to stop the exercises after just a few minutes and continue with our daily work as usual. We must not let thoughts of our exercises mingle with our work. Whoever has not learned to wait, in the noblest and best sense of the word, is unsuited to esoteric work and will never achieve results of any real value. Subsection: Controlling Our Thoughts and Feelings. Paragraph 17. As we seek esoteric knowledge on the path described above, one thought can give us strength in all our efforts. We must never forget that we may already have advanced quite far, even though this progress has not manifested in ways we might expect. If we do not remember this, we can easily lose heart and give up our efforts completely. In the beginning, the forces and capacities that we must develop are extremely delicate. Their nature is quite other than we previously imagined. Until now, we have been used to dealing only with the physical world. The realms of soul and spirit had escaped our vision and our grasp. Thus, it is not surprising that we do not notice immediately that forces of soul and spirit are beginning to develop in us. There is the possibility of error here for anyone who undertakes an esoteric path while remaining ignorant of the experiences gathered by accomplished spiritual researchers. Such spiritual researchers can see our progress long before we are aware of it. They know that delicate spiritual eyes can develop before we are aware of them. Indeed, the instructions of researchers are for the most part designed to keep us from losing our confidence, patience, and perseverance at a time when we cannot yet see our progress for ourselves. Esoteric teachers cannot give us anything that is not already present, although concealed, within us. They can only guide us in the development of our own dormant capacities. Nevertheless, what they communicate out of their experience will be a help to us when we seek to struggle from the darkness into the light. Paragraph 18. Many people abandon the path to occult knowledge soon after embarking upon it, because they do not notice any immediate progress. Students often mistake their first perceptible higher experiences for illusions when these do not correspond with what they had expected. Such students lose courage because they consider their first experiences worthless, or because these experiences seem insignificant and unlikely to lead to anything more valuable in the foreseeable future. Courage and self-confidence are two beacons that should never be extinguished on the path to higher knowledge. No one who cannot patiently repeat an exercise that has failed, to all appearances, countless times before, will travel far on this path. Paragraph 19. Long before we have a clear perception of our progress, we have a vague feeling that we are on the right track. This feeling should be cultivated and nurtured, for it can become a reliable guide. Above all, we must eradicate the belief that only bizarre and mysterious practices lead to higher knowledge. We should be clear that development begins with the feelings and thoughts we live with all the time, but that these feelings and thoughts must be given a new, unaccustomed direction. We must say to ourselves, quote, "Within my own feelings and thoughts the highest mysteries lie concealed, but until now I have not perceived them." Close quote. In the final analysis, everything is based on the simple fact that though we carry body and soul and spirit about with us, we are conscious only of the body. The esoteric student must become as conscious of soul and spirit as the ordinary person is of his or her body. Paragraph 20. It all comes down to giving our feelings and thoughts the right direction. Only then can we gain the ability to see what ordinarily remains invisible. One of the ways of achieving this will be given here. Once again, it is a simple exercise, like almost everything that has been presented so far. Yet the effects of this exercise, if carried out with perseverance, devotion, and the necessary inner mood, will be far-reaching. Paragraph 21. We place before us a small seed from a plant. Starting with this insignificant thing, the point will be to think the right thoughts intensively, and by means of these thoughts, to develop certain feelings. First, we must establish what we are really seeing with our eyes. We describe to ourselves the form, color, and other properties of the seed. Then we ponder the thought, quote, "This seed, if planted in the ground, will grow into a complex plant." Close quote. We visualize the plant. We make it present to and in us. We build it up in imagination. Then we think, quote, "What I now visualize in my imagination, forces of earth and light, will later, in reality, draw forth from this small seed. But if this were an artificial seed, an artificial copy, so perfect that my eyes could not distinguish it from a real seed, then no forces of earth and light would ever be able to draw forth such a plant from it." Close quote. If we can clearly form this thought and bring it to life within us, then we will be able to form the next thought easily and with the right feeling. Quote, "Within the seed already lies concealed what, as the force of the whole plant, later grows out of it." The artificial copy of the seed has no such force. Yet, to my eyes, both seeds look the same. Therefore, the real seed contains something invisible that is absent in the copy. Close quote, footnote. To object here that a microscopic examination would reveal the differences between the real seed and the artificial copy is to admit that one has not understood what is at issue here. The point is not to determine what exactly we are looking at, but to develop soul spiritual forces. End of footnote. Thoughts and feelings should now focus on this invisible reality. We must imagine that this invisible force or reality will, in the course of time, change into the visible plant, whose color and form we will be able to see before us. We should hold the thought, quote, "The invisible will become visible. If I were unable to think, then what later becomes visible could not announce itself to me now." Close quote. Paragraph 22. It is important to emphasize that whatever we think, we must also feel with intensity. Meditative thoughts need to be experienced calmly and peacefully. No other thoughts should distract us. Time should be allowed for both the thought and the feeling united with it to penetrate the soul. If this is done in the right way, then after a time, perhaps only after many unsuccessful attempts, we become conscious of a new force within us. This creates a new perception. The seed seems to be enclosed in a small cloud of light. In a sensory, spiritual way, we sense it as a kind of flame. At its center, we experience a sensation similar to the impression made by the color purple, at its edges a sensation similar to the color blue. What we could not see before now becomes apparent to us, created by the force of the thoughts and feelings that we have awakened within us. The plant, which is still physically invisible and will not become visible until later, is revealed to us in a spiritually visible manner. Paragraph 23. Understandably, some people consider all this mere illusion. Many will say, quote, "I do not want to have anything to do with such hallucinations and visions." Close quote. Some will fall away and abandon the path. What it comes down to is this: fantasy and spiritual reality must not be confused in this complex matter of inner development. We must have the courage to push forward and not become faint-hearted and fearful. On the other hand, we must always cultivate a healthy sense for the distinction between truth and illusion. We should never lose conscious self-control during the exercises. Our thinking must be as certain and reliable in carrying out the exercises as it is when we apply it to the things and processes of everyday life. We must remain clear-headed and down to earth at all times. It would be very bad indeed if we fell into daydreaming. Our reasoning must be perfectly lucid, even sober, at all times. The greatest mistake would be to lose our equilibrium through such exercises, and thus be hindered from forming as sound and sensible opinions in everyday life as we did before. Therefore, we should examine ourselves repeatedly to ensure that we have not lost our balance, and that we still remain the same within the relationships of our daily lives as we were before we started the exercises. Steady inner calm and a clear mind for all things. These must be preserved. Above all, we must take care not to indulge each passing reverie or give ourselves up to every possible different kind of exercise. The directions for thinking given here have been tested and practiced in occult schools from the most ancient times. Only such time-tested methods are presented here. To use other methods, either ones we have created ourselves or those we have read or heard about, will lead inevitably to a path of error and boundless fantasy. Paragraph 24. A further exercise connected to the seed meditation is the following. We place before us a mature plant. First, we immerse ourselves in the thought, quote, "A time will come when this plant will wither and decay. Everything I see now will then no longer exist. But the plant will have produced seeds, and these will become new plants. Thus, once again, I become aware that something I cannot see lies hidden in what I can see." Close quote. We saturate ourselves with the thought, quote, "The plant form, with all its colors, will soon no longer be there. But the knowledge that the plant produces seeds teaches me that it will not disappear into nothingness. I cannot see what preserves the plant from disappearance any more than I could see the future plant in the seed. Therefore it follows that there is something in the plant, too, that I cannot see with my eyes. But if I let this thought live within me, and the appropriate feeling unites with it, Then after a time, new force will grow in my soul and become a new perception. Close quote. A kind of spiritual flame form will then grow out of the plant. Of course, this flame will be correspondingly larger than the one described in the case of the seed. It will be felt as green-blue at its center and as yellow-red at its periphery. Paragraph 25. Again, it must be strongly emphasized that we do not see what are here called colors in the same way that we see colors with our physical eyes. Rather, through spiritual perception, we experience something similar to the impression made by physical colors. To perceive blue spiritually is to feel or sense an impression similar to the one we feel when our physical eyes dwell on the color blue. We must remember this if we wish to ascend gradually to true spiritual perception. If we do not, we will expect the spiritual world to be a replica of the physical world, which would confuse us in the worst way. Paragraph 26. Once we have reached the point of such spiritual seeing, we have already achieved much. Things now reveal to us not only their present being, but also their arising and passing away. We begin to see the spirit, of which our physical eyes know nothing, everywhere. We have begun to approach the mystery of birth and death with our own intuitive vision. As far as our physical senses are concerned, an entity comes into being with birth and passes away with death. But this is only because the outer senses cannot perceive the hidden spirit. For the spirit, birth and death are merely transformations, just as the burgeoning of a bud into a blossom is a transformation occurring before our physical eyes. To come to know this firsthand through our own spiritual vision, we must first awaken spiritual senses for it in the way indicated here. Paragraph 27. Those who have had some soul or psychic experience of the supersensible worlds might object that there are shorter and simpler ways to attain spiritual perception. Indeed, it cannot be disputed that some people come to know the phenomena of birth and death through personal vision without undertaking the exercises described here. Some people have considerable psychic gifts, which require only slight stimulation in order to be developed further. But such people are exceptional. The path described here is safer and more generally effective. A person may achieve some knowledge of chemistry in unusual ways, but if we wish to become real chemists, we must follow the more certain and generally accepted path. Paragraph 28. We would be committing a serious error with far-reaching consequences if we believed that we could reach our objective more easily by dispensing with the actual object of our meditation and simply forming a mental picture of the seed or plant that we then held in our imaginations. This path may indeed also lead us to results, but it is not as sure and proven as the one presented in this book. For the perceptions we attain in this way often turn out to be delusions of fantasy, and we must then wait for these to be transformed into genuine spiritual vision. The point of these exercises is not that we arbitrarily create perceptions for ourselves, but that reality creates them in us. The truth must well up from the depths of our own souls, but the ordinary capital I should not be the magician who conjures up the truth. The beings whose spiritual truth I seek to behold must conjure their own truth. Paragraph 29. When, by practicing such exercises, we have discovered in ourselves the first rudiments of spiritual perception, we can then go on to contemplate our fellow human beings. We begin by selecting some simple phenomena connected with human life. But before we take this step, we must work sincerely and seriously on the integrity of our moral character. We must remove all thoughts of ever using the knowledge gained in this way for our own self-interest. We must firmly decide never to use for evil ends any power we might gain over other people. Thus, if we seek to penetrate the mysteries of human nature through our own efforts, we must abide by the golden rule of the occult sciences. This rule states, quote, "For every single step that you take in seeking knowledge of hidden truths, you must take 3 steps in perfecting your character toward the good." Close quote. Whoever follows this rule can do the following exercises. Paragraph 30. We visualize a person whom we have observed longing for something, and we direct our attention to this desire. It is best to recall the moment when the desire was strongest, and we did not yet know whether the person would obtain the object of their desire. Then we surrender ourselves to this picture, completely dedicated to what we can observe in our memory. We create the greatest imaginable inner calm in our souls. We try as far as possible to be deaf and blind to everything else going on around us. Above all, we pay close attention to any feeling that the mental image we have formed awakens in our souls. Then we allow this feeling to rise up within us like a cloud on an otherwise empty horizon. Naturally, this exercise often breaks down. We find that we were, usually, unable to observe the person who is the object of our attention in a state of desire for a sufficient length of time. The lack of first-hand observation interferes with our contemplation and cuts it short. Thus we may have to make hundreds upon hundreds of unsuccessful attempts. Above all, we must not lose patience. Eventually, after many attempts, we shall experience in ourselves a feeling corresponding to the inner soul state of the individual we are contemplating. Then, before long, we begin to notice that this feeling produces a force in the soul. This force, then, becomes the spiritual perception of the other person's soul state. An image experienced as shining enters our field of vision. This spiritual, shining picture is the so-called astral embodiment of the state of soul we observed, that is, of the desire. As before, we perceive this as flame-like. Its center gives an impression of the color yellow-red, and its periphery affects us as the color red-blue or purple would. It is important that we handle these spiritual perceptions gently. It is best, to begin with, not to talk about them, except perhaps with our teacher, if we have one. If we try to describe such a phenomenon in inappropriate language, it usually leads to gross delusions. Ordinary words were not made for such things, and are too coarse and clumsy to do them justice. The result is that when we attempt to describe our experience in such words, we are misled into mixing all kinds of fantastic illusions with real spiritual visions. Here, then, is another important rule for the student of occult knowledge. Quote, "Know how to be silent about your spiritual perceptions. Yes, even be silent about them with yourself. Do not try to clothe in words what you see in the spirit, nor try to understand it with your ordinary unskilled reason. Give yourself fully to your spiritual perception, and do not disturb it with too much pondering. Remember that your thinking is not yet on the level of your spiritual vision. You have acquired this thinking in a life that until now has been limited wholly to the physical world. But once you are now acquiring, but what you are now acquiring goes beyond that. Therefore, do not seek to measure these new higher perceptions by the same standard that you measured your older ones. Close quote. Once we can observe our inner experiences steadily, then we can speak about them and thereby inspire our fellow human beings to activity. Paragraph 31. The above exercise may be supplemented by the following complementary one. This time we contemplate a person whose desire or longing has been fulfilled. Following the same rules and precautions as before, we attain another, different spiritual perception. We again see a spiritual flame form, but now this feels yellow in the center and light green at the periphery. Paragraph 32. Observing and contemplating our fellow human beings in this way, we can easily fall into a moral error. We can lose our love for them. We must do everything imaginable to ensure that this does not happen. In fact, we should undertake these exercises only when we have developed the absolute certainty that thoughts are realities. Then we shall not allow ourselves to think of our fellow human beings in any way that is incompatible with the profound respect due their dignity and freedom. The idea that another person could be merely an object of observation must never, even for a moment, take hold of us. Every esoteric observation of human nature must be accompanied by self-education and the ability to appreciate unreservedly the full individual value of every person. All that dwells within each human being, including thoughts and feelings, must be considered holy and inviolable. We must be filled with a profound awe for everything human, even in our memories and recollections. Paragraph 33. These preliminary exercises give two examples of how we may gain insight into human nature. If nothing else, they show the path that we must follow. Indeed, we need only discover the necessary inner quiet and calm belonging to such meditations for our souls to undergo a great transformation. The inner enrichment that we experience in our being soon makes even our outer conduct more confident and serene. And this transformed behavior then reacts positively upon our souls. Thereby we help ourselves along in our development. We will always find ways and means of discovering more and more of human nature that is hidden from our outer senses. As we do so, we gradually progress to the point of glimpsing the mysterious kinship between human nature and all else that exists in the universe. In this way, we shall be drawing closer to the moment when we can take the first steps in the stage of initiation. But before we can take these first steps, one thing more is necessary, though, to begin with, we cannot see why this is so. Later, however, we shall understand it. Paragraph 34. Candidates for initiation must bring with them two additional qualities, courage and fearlessness. These have a certain relationship with each other and must be developed together. And as esoteric students, we must deliberately seek out situations in which these virtues can be cultivated. Indeed, in occult training, they are developed quite systematically. From this point of view, life itself is also a good occult school, perhaps the best. We must be able to look danger calmly in the eye and overcome difficulties without hesitation. When facing a danger, we should immediately be stirred to the conviction, quote, "All fear is useless. I must not let it take hold of me. I must think only of what is to be done." Close quote. In fact, we must reach a point in situations that earlier would have caused us to be afraid, in which the very idea of fear and lack of courage become things impossible for us to conceive in the core of our soul. Such self-education in courage and fearlessness develops quite specific forces that we need for initiation into higher knowledge. Just as we need healthy nerves as physical beings to make use of our physical senses, so, as beings of soul, we need the strength that develops only in courageous and fearless natures. For as we penetrate the higher mysteries, we see things that were previously hidden from us by the illusions of the senses. In fact, it is a blessing that our physical senses do not allow us to perceive the higher truths. In this way, they protect us from things that, if we saw them unprepared, would cause us great dismay, things we could not bear to see. As students of the occult, we must train ourselves to bear these sights. In the process, we shall inevitably lose some of the supports that the external world provided for us, as long as we were caught up in its illusions. What happens is literally the same as when people are made aware of a danger that was present for a long time, but which they knew nothing of. Unaware of the danger, they were, of course, also unafraid. But once they know about it, they are overcome with fear, even though the danger has not increased by their knowing about it. Paragraph 35. The world's powers are both destructive and constructive. The fate of sense-perceptible beings is to arise and pass away. The initiate must see and understand how these forces and this fate work themselves out. For this, the veil that lies before our spiritual eyes in ordinary life must be removed. Of course, we ourselves are closely interwoven with these forces and with fate. Our individual natures, like the world, contain destructive and constructive forces. As initiates, our own souls will be revealed before our seeing eyes as nakedly as all other things. Students must not lose strength in the face of such self-knowledge. They must come to meet it with a surplus of forces. In order to have this surplus, we must learn to maintain our inward calm and certainty in difficult life situations and cultivate an unshakable trust in the good powers of existence. We should be prepared for the fact that many motives that have previously guided us can no longer do so. We shall have to realize that we thought and did many things simply because we were caught up in ignorance. The grounds we had for doing things no longer hold good. We may often have acted out of conceit, but we now come to realize how unspeakably useless all vanity is to the initiate. We have been motivated by greed. Now we realize how destructive greed is. We have to develop completely new grounds for acting and thinking. This is what involves courage and fearlessness. Paragraph 36. Above all, we need to cultivate courage and fearlessness in the inmost depths of our thought life itself. We must learn not to be discouraged by failure. We should be able to think, quote, "I will forget that I have failed again, and will try once more, as if it never happened." Close quote. In this way, we struggle to the conviction that the sources of strength in the world that we can draw from are inexhaustible. Again and again we aspire to the Spirit, which will lift us up and carry us, regardless of how often our earthly being proves to be weak and powerless. We must become capable of living into the future and not let any past experiences disturb our striving. Once we have developed the above-described qualities to a certain extent, we are ready to learn the true names of things. These names are the keys to higher knowledge. Initiation is learning to call the things of the world by the names they have in the minds of their divine authors. These names contain the secrets of things. Initiates speak a different language from the uninitiated, because as initiates, they call things by the names through which they were created. To the extent that initiation can be talked about at all, it will be discussed in the next chapter. The end of chapter 2.